Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm going to tell you how you can tell when you've really changed. Maybe you think that's a silly thing. Maybe you're thinking, well, damn, I'm the one who knows when I've changed or not. But really, I think that's not true. I think we're the last to know. So if you keep listening, you'll find out what I mean by that. And after I tell you how you can tell when you've really changed, then I'm going to play an interview with, as I say in the show, a true Renaissance man. A man who, well, you'll hear. This is Bob Gussin, who I interviewed because I thought he was a mystery writer, because I found him at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention, but he's not a mystery writer. And although he is a writer, and he is many, many, many more things. So it's a really interesting show, and if you hang on, it'll be coming around right now.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice. From the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show, which is today being brought to you by Asheville Hot Air Balloons in Asheville, North Carolina. Are you overwhelmed by all the unexpected things that are happening in our world? As a therapist, I know that one of the best ways to deal with difficult problems is sometimes just to take a break from them. And there is no better break than getting up above it all in a hot air balloon. Your burdens will lift, your perspective will change, and you'll feel liberated. It's fun, it's therapeutic, and it's cheaper than therapy. Tell them that you heard about Asheville Hot Air Balloons on The Lynn Show, and contact Asheville Hot Air Balloons either at their website, ashevillehotairballoons.com, or call them at 828-667-9943. That's 828-667-9943. Hello, and do welcome to The Lynn Show. Today, as I said in the opening, I'm going to be playing an interview I did with Bob Gutton, who is rather a Renaissance man. I interviewed Bob, as I did the other seven people who hopefully you will be hearing in the next few weeks, at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention. It turns out Bob is not a mystery writer. I am reading his book, Trash Talk, as we speak. It's adorable. And you'll hear him say that when he got done with it, he realized there was no mystery in it. He had written a comic novel and had just expected that the mystery would show up. He attends the mystery writer conventions because his wife, Pat, is actually a writer of mysteries. And he himself is now a publisher of mysteries and thrillers, although that is not the least of what this man has done, is doing, and will continue to do in his life. So look forward to that interview. I'm going to start out the show by talking a little bit about how you know when you have actually changed. I've talked a great deal in these shows about how hard it is to change, and I will continue to do that, to tell you about the obstacles that get in our way when we want to change. If you are tuning in for the first time, or if I mention something that you would like to hear more about, there is a very good likelihood that you can find that information on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. You can find out about me, about the psychotherapy that I practice, about the book that I wrote, about the CD that I created, pretty much anything that you ever wanted to know about me. But you can also find out what I have to say about why people can't change when they want to. Before I play Bob's interview, I'm going to talk a little bit about how you know it when it actually has happened to you. You notice that I said it has happened to you, because actually maybe I should say something about that. We think in this culture that change is something we do. Actually, I believe that as long as we're doing it, making it happen, forcing it, causing it, instigating it, that it hasn't actually happened. If it takes the effort of will, of concentration, of desire, of intention, we haven't really changed. We may change behavior, it may look like we've changed, but until the change is integrated, evolutionary, part of us, it's just going to snap back. So whatever it is that you made yourself do, suddenly you will find you are no longer doing. Real change is possible, but real change happens to you, not you do it. So I will be talking much, much more about how that happens, what you have to do to set the stage for, create the environment in which a change can occur within you and then be demonstrated without. And the irony is that when we have really changed, quite often, because the change is integrated, because it feels so much like us, we are the last to know. It doesn't feel different. You know, when you're trying to make a change, you know that the thing feels weird, it feels awkward, it feels good, whatever it feels, but it feels different. You're aware of it. When a change has really happened, you don't notice, because it's just you. So it's actually the response of your families, original and current, that is the litmus test that validates your change. Do you know what that means? It means that you can tell by the way you are treated by the others in your family, and friends, and colleagues, and siblings, and children, and employees, and neighbors, whether you have changed or not. You may not see just how delicately balanced families are until you actually begin to change, and I've talked a great deal about balance and how you can test the balance in your family. But again, you can find that on the website. when other members of your family, friends, etc., begin to feel unbalanced, then you will know for certain that you have changed or are changing. A sure sign that this is happening is when you begin to hear people, all those people I mentioned, saying things like, "Are you sure you're okay? Do you know what you're doing? What's going on? You've disappointed me. You're hurting us. You've let us down." These questions and statements can come directly from family members, like spouse, parents, or children. They can come from extended family members, like cousins, aunts, or grandparents. But non-family members can also be called on to apply pressure to you to return you to who you always have been. So you may hear from your wife's best friend or your husband's boss. I had a client named Teresa who came to see me when she was 58. And one of the things that Teresa needed to do in her life was to stop spending every weekend with her elderly parents. And when she was finally able to do that is to say, she didn't feel like going, she started to get reproachful telephone calls from her parents' next-door neighbors. They just wanted her to know how much her parents missed her and how much they looked forward to her next visit. So you may not have anticipated or really be prepared for the reaction you get, but if you're really beginning to make a significant change in who you are, that is, who you have always acted as though, there will more than likely be a reaction from those people who have always counted on your being the way you have always been. So, this is just something to keep an eye out for. I don't know where you are in the process of change. And I am fond of saying it. In fact, I have a t-shirt and a card that says, change is a process. It's not an event. So, I don't know where you are in that process. But I do know that the work of change is first to discover what it is that's standing between you and the change you want to make. And perhaps, very often, actually, the obstacle that's standing between you and the change you want to make is that you are acting a particular role which you believe you have to be, just to who you are. But that may not be true. What may more likely be true is that you're acting a role which I call your cover story. Your cover story, like a spy has a cover story. And in our case, not the spy's case necessarily, but in our case, the cover story is actually the truth. It's just not the whole story. So when we say that's just who I am, what we really mean is this is all of the me that I've been able to demonstrate. There's more of you. So next week, I'm going to talk about, or begin to talk about, because there won't be much time, because I'm going to keep playing these interviews with people who make their living or their life with their art. And therefore, in that area of their life, are really who they are. And you'll hear that in Bob Gussin. I mean, he is so very, very much who he really is. But I will talk about the cover story, how we get it, what it means, how you can figure out yours. So that's coming up next week. But what's going to come up right now is a public service announcement. And then following the public service announcement, there will be my interview with Bob Gussin.
My son was drinking too much. When did he spiral out of control? Should I have seen the warning signs? Somehow, I felt I was responsible for his drinking. I was very frustrated, and I knew I had to get help. When I came to Al-Anon, I wanted to straighten out my son's life. His drinking was tearing our family apart. In Al-Anon family groups, I found people who understood and cared because they were dealing with the same problems I was. My first Al-Anon meeting gave me hope and the knowledge that I was not alone.
Before you can help the problem drinker in your life, you need to help yourself first. For an Al-Anon family group meeting near you, call 1-888-4-ALANON, 1-888-425-2666. online at www.alanonfamilygroups.org. That's alanonfamilygroups.org. A message from Al-Anon Family Groups.
So I'm here with Bob Gussin at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention in Sarasota, Florida. And I don't know Bob, but I just heard a lot of things about him. So I want to start by telling you that I usually interview people who make their living or their life with their art. And I tend to define art in a very broad way. So I suppose related to a kind of passion, you know?
Yes.
As opposed to, I did this thing because I had to do something. Do you know what I mean?
I don't think I've ever done anything because I had to do
it. I think that's exactly right, and I'd really like you to talk about that, if you don't mind.
Certainly.
To talk about, just to catch the audience up a little bit, what I know is that you were a medical researcher, you have a vineyard, you run a publishing company, a book publishing company, and you are an author.
That's correct.
And maybe there's even more I don't know, but all of those things generally have some kind of passion behind them. You don't simply say, oh, I think, you know, I'll start a vineyard. I mean, it's...
No, it didn't happen that way.
No.
It took a little impulsiveness, and it does take passion. It takes passion to do any of those things. It certainly took passion in my career in medical research. I was very fortunate in being able to touch many, many areas of medical research because my last 26 years were with Johnson & Johnson. My last 14 years, I was their chief scientific officer.
Wow.
So I had the oversight over probably 12,000 scientists and physicians around the world, and we were in virtually every area of medicine. So I went from being a specialist as a researcher to
becoming a generalist.
I always said I went from knowing almost everything about nothing to knowing almost nothing and maybe nothing about everything.
Yes.
I was working my way to that. But I was able to get involved with the development of coronary artery stents, with many drugs, with artificial joints, with surgical instrumentation for minimally invasive surgery. So it was an exciting and passion-filled field because you're helping people and you're
yes.
seeing the
And that's what the passion's
that
about.
That's what
right?
the passion's about.
Yeah.
And then it was tradition for corporate officers at Johnson & Johnson to retire at 62. And so 2 years prior to my 62nd birthday, I told the CEO, whom I reported to, that I would retire on February 1st, 2000, for several reasons. One, it was tradition. I'd be 62 years old. Secondly, I would have finished my 26th year with Johnson & Johnson. And thirdly, as I got older and even more senile, I always felt that if I retired in 2000, it would be easy to tell people how long I've been retired. So that all worked out. So that's the story of that career. Now, after I retired, I consulted back to Johnson & Johnson for a couple of years. But in the meantime, my wife, who was a physician, and had also come into research and ended up with J&J too, for 24 years, decided to retire the same day I did because she couldn't imagine me running around doing nothing while she was off at work. But she also started, for many reasons, writing novels 2 years before we retired. She had responsibilities in Japan and China, and she had never had as much time to think about things as she had on these long flights. And she started to think back to the days when she was in medical school in Detroit in 1967 during the riots.
Wow.
And one thing led to another, and she ended up deciding she would like to write fiction, thrillers, the first one being based on her time in Detroit during the riots, because now she had time to think about the importance of that, because we have 7 kids and 17 grandkids. So being in med school with a few kids and all that other stuff didn't give her a lot of time to think about the world's problems. Anyway, she started to write, and when we retired, she had time to attend meetings such as the one we are at today. And she kept urging me to come with her. And somewhere along the way, I finally got an interest that I never had, and that was to write something fiction. I'd written chapters in medical texts, things like that. And I started out to try to... Carl Hiaasen is a... I love his writing. And Tim Dorsey. And I thought, I'll write a mystery that'll be funny and will have a message in it. And those authors often write about environmental issues because Florida's a pretty environmentally conscientious state. So I thought that's what I would do. Excuse me. And I started to do that. And I was thinking about the environmental aspect. And I thought about global warming and global cooling. And that didn't seem to fit. And I thought, garbage, litter, trash. And then I call myself a sports fan. My wife calls me a sports fanatic. I sort of, my sports brain kicked in. And I thought, trash. Trash talk. That would be my title.
It's a great
title. And I thought, what? And the theme that came to me was, what would happen if a bunch of professional athletes accidentally went to an environmental meeting because the meeting was titled Trash Talk, and they thought it was insulting stuff, and they get there, and it's recycling, waste hauling, etc. So that's what I started thinking about, and I thought, well, how do you get these athletes to a meeting like that, to attend something like that? Well, that night I picked up the paper, and there was another behavior problem in professional athletics. Some athlete beat up his girlfriend or something, and it was a big article in the paper. I thought, you know, what if the commissioners of football, basketball, baseball, and hockey got together and decided, trying to figure out how they can change the behavior of these athletes. And one thing they decided was, we will impose a continuing education requirement that once a year, if you want to play in these leagues, you will go to a symposium, a course, whatever, outside the area of sports. It'd be anywhere from a day to a week, and your team will pay for it, and it has to be out of season. They said, that sounds like a pretty good start. Mm-hmm. So they imposed this. Well, the players went crazy. I mean, they make a ton of money. They figure, why? Many of them didn't graduate college. Why should I now go back to things I don't want to go to? And they're moaning and groaning, and somebody sees in the newspaper a very small ad that says, SCS sponsors symposium Trash Talk, Sarasota, Florida, May 1st to 5th. And this is our specialty. You know, if we have to go, we can hone our skills. We're the masters
of trash talk.
You know? So they start calling in, and they get a temporary employee. So we want to register for the Trash Talk Symposium. Fine, we'll take your name, but we've already given out all our materials, so when you come to register, we'll have your packet.
Very
no, that's fine. No problem with that. And I'll take, you know, get me a good hotel room, Ritz-Carlton, something like that. Who are these people? But they're getting calls left and right. So they're happy. This little Sarasota Environmental Society office is really registering a lot of people. Well, registration day, it hits the fan, as they say, when the first athlete gets their packet and they see recycling, waste hauling, etc. So they're irate. They think they've been duped and, you know, they're going to kill the organizers. And they're going to say, wait, it's a misunderstanding. We'll give you your money back. And they go, we don't want our money back. We're staying.
We need have credit. To take this, right.
Right, so you're going to change the program. So overnight, a little committee of both gets together, and they change the program. So now it has both types. It has the insulting stuff. It has the environmental stuff. So the real theme of the book is now you get these two very different cultures together for 4 days in a meeting and in the evenings out on the town. And a lot of funny things happen. But there's also evidence that these two very different types of people are beginning to understand each other a little more and an appreciation for the environment. And so there are no bad guys in it. It's good guys, a lot of funny stuff. And I wrote it. I loved it. I laughed and my wife laughed, except I never got it to be a mystery.
I was just going to say.
It's sports humor. You know, somebody said you start writing a book and your characters do what they want to do. Well, mine did. And they didn't want to go to be a mystery. So I'm not part of the mystery club, but I have written a book. So that's the author part of me. Now, 2 years after my wife and I retired from Johnson & Johnson, a man who worked for me, who ran a very, very top-notch molecular genetics lab in Sydney, Australia, that I started. That was one of the benefits I had of being the chief scientific officer. I had some opportunities. One of them was to start a research group in Australia. And I built up over 14 years a very, very top-notch laboratory. And the guy that I hired to run it, I hired from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, an Australian whom I knew from our work. He was in the same, he was a kidney specialist, as was I. And he is a very well-known MD, PhD, and he came to work for me and ran the lab. He decided to retire 2 years after Pat and I did. And they invited us over for his big week-long festivities for his retirement and asked me if I'd be the keynote speaker, which was quite an honor. But since I started the lab and hired him, they figured that was appropriate. So I said to Pat, you know, in all the years, I went to Sydney three or four times a year for 14 years, and Pat had gone on her own for business and with me a few times. We never had a chance to go to New Zealand, and many, many people, they figure if you're going to Australia, Americans think Australia is attached to New Zealand by a bridge. It's about 1,500 miles apart, but you figure if you're in that part of the world, have you ever gone to New Zealand? Because it's beautiful. Everybody says it's beautiful. So we never had time, but now we hadn't gotten into a whole lot of other things. We're writing, we're consulting back to Johnson & Johnson, but we had time. So we said, look, let's take a couple weeks, 2.5 weeks, we'll go to New Zealand prior to going to Sydney, and we did. And in those 2 weeks, we fell in love with the country, and Pat primarily fell in love with the vineyards. They're just beautiful. I mean, parts of New Zealand are just covered with vineyards. I mean, it was like the California Gold Rush. They've torn out cherry trees, apple trees, everything, and planted grapes because they realize they can grow grapes, and a ton of grapes worth a lot more than a ton of apples, you know. You make wine out of grapes. You can't do much with the apples. But anyhow, she started saying to me, wouldn't it be fun to be in the wine business in New Zealand? I was like the typical husband, I think. Tried to ignore it. I just,
Sure,
I said, All I could say is, and I ignored it. She kept talking every day. She's talking to people there. We'd stop in a restaurant. She's talking about the vineyards and the grapes. So we got to Australia, and it turned out one of the people in my lab came from a family who had been growing grapes for over 50 years in Australia. They were one of the primary suppliers to the Australian wine industry. So I got him aside and I said, Wayne, Pat's driving me crazy. She keeps talking about getting into the wine business in New Zealand. And he said, Bob, that would be one of the best investments you could ever make. I was shocked. I mean, he was like a clone of Pat's brain, you know. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's going crazy. You can make money. You can have fun. He said, my sister, who's a master's degree enologist and winemaker, just moved from Australia to New Zealand to be a winemaker for a big New Zealand winery. He said, I'll tell you what. I'll put you in touch with her by email, and she can give you some ideas. Well, that was like the knockout punch. 4 months later, we bought a vineyard. The American dollar was very strong. The New Zealand dollar was weak.
Perfect timing.
We got
timing.
A pretty good deal. There are groups that can run the vineyard for
you. Of course,
you.
I was going to say, you don't...
Oh, no, we're not
right,
hands-on.
Right, you're not hands-on,
we
right.
We make decisions like, you know, change irrigation system, put in new pumps. I mean,
Well, and
your
medical, I mean, it's a kind of a technical thing that, no?
Yeah, it
you're
is. Looking, there's some scientific stuff.
Yeah.
And we do understand a bit.
Right.
But we're surely not expert. And, in fact, we're not big wine connoisseurs. We love to drink wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this seemed like...
So what do you make?
We grow 200 tons of grapes a year. We have 70 acres now. We have two vineyards. 100 tons are Sauvignon Blanc, which are the best in the world. Marlborough, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is accepted as the best Sauvignon Blanc in the world, and ours is one of the most award-winning wines. It's Villa Maria wine. You can buy it here even hand. In fact, the public supermarket has our Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, my God.
But the other 100 tons, 50 tons are Pinot Noir, which is incredible. It's a little harder to get here because it's a hard grape to grow, and we're a small country, so there's not that much exported. But the wine stores have it, but you have to order it, and they'll have it in a couple of days because the distributors have it. And the other 50 tons are Chardonnay. And they're good, but they're not anything exceptional. They're like the Australian Chardonnays. They're a little different than California, but... So we're having a ball, and I mean, we go a couple times a year. We go for the harvest, and we go once in their spring or fall.
And you don't have to buy wine anymore.
We buy our own wine. You know, the sad part of this story is we're not dealers. So
you
buy
don't have
retail.
A deal.
So everybody thinks since we own the vineyards,
you should be giving everybody a bottle of wine.
Oh, it's worse than that. It's every charity comes to us. Can you donate 12 cases of wine for this charity thing we do?
That's right.
Sure. So I go to the wine store. I buy 12 cases of wine, get a 10% discount because I bought so many cases. Then I give it away. But it's been a ball because, you know, if we go to restaurants and you start talking, do you have New Zealand wines? And you have...
Oh, my God. And you say that's ours. Oh, my God.
So it's been a lot of fun. And we don't, we don't day-to-day. We're not heavy lifters there. But we do, you know, we changed our irrigation primary site from a dam on our property to the river and made the dam secondary. We tore down a sheep shearing barn that was on one of our vineyards and replanted that area. Those are decisions we make because obviously it's our money going
right.
into it. But it's been a fun business. We've had a great
clearly,
time.
It's clearly.
One thing we did learn, 1 year before we had the second vineyard, we had a frost, one night frost that dropped 1 degree below the frost level, and we lost 80% of our crop that year. The next day, we happened to be there, and we visited the vineyard. It looked beautiful. It was green and lush. And that night, we had the frost, and we went the next day, and it looked like a fall day up north here where, you know, the leaves crumble in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what it was. So we took a real bath, a financial bath on that one. But that's the only year. Every other year, we've run into black. So it's been reasonable. I'm not making a fortune, but we're having fun and we're not losing money.
No, it's wonderful.
So that's how we got into the wine business and in the writing business. And then I was going to these writers' meetings with Pat. I had written my one book. I was happy. I threw in a drawer. I wrote the manuscript, tossed in the drawer.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Pat had her first novel with a big New York publisher, a big New York agent, and he was confident that he would get it published with a big publisher. And I was going to these meetings, and while she would go to sessions to learn about how to develop your characters, et cetera, I sort of go and take a nap here and there in sessions, you know. But I did go to one. I was just curious about what it took to publish a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a session at the Sleuth Fest meeting here in Florida on self-publishing. I didn't want to be a self-publisher, but I was just wondering what it took
mm-hmm.
to publish. So I'm listening, and, you know, what the parts are, what goes into publishing a book. And at the same time, I'm thinking, I come to these meetings, and all I hear are authors talking about how we can't get
an agent,
published.
And we can't get a publisher.
Or if we do, and even a big publisher, they don't pay any attention to
That's
us,
right.
you know, all that stuff. So I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I could do this. I could publish a book, and I could handle a few authors, not a lot, but and I could probably do more for them. Than they're getting. I mean, we had pretty successful careers. We had a little bit of money we could invest. Probably could invest in something better in the publishing business, but I thought, you know...
Well, in terms of money, but not in terms of...
Well, not in terms of fun and passion.
Right.
No, in terms
and
of
doing
money,
good. I'm not sure.
Good. We are doing good. We
yeah.
really are doing not financially good. I mean, we're doing good for some people.
Yes.
And so I went and I met Pat for lunch and I said, I got an idea. I said, I think I'm going to start a publishing company. Well, there was like a stunned moment of silence. You know?
This is her version of I want to buy a vineyard.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
This is payback.
That's right.
Payback for
That's
that.
Right.
So I said, I think I'm going to start a publishing company. So she sat there. Why do you want to do that? And I told her, and she said, Well, okay. She said, but the first book you're going to publish is mine.
Mine, right?
I said, I can't do that. I said, first of all, you're going to get published by a big publisher, and they can do a lot better for you than I can. And secondly, I want to avoid the appearance of self-publishing. The first book I published is my wife's book. What's
right.
that look like?
Right.
You know? No, she said, you're going to make mistakes on the first book. And I want you to make them on mine, not somebody else's. So I said, okay, I'll do it, but I think it's wrong. So in the meantime, I lined up four other authors. So I now had five authors come out the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured, well, she's one of them, but at least I can explain away
right.
after the first
she's
book.
She's in the group. She's
right.
not the only one.
But she's
one.
The first one.
Right.
That's sad part. I mean, that was my opinion at the time. So we published her book, and we published three outside authors, and then we published mine last in that
mm-hmm.
year. And I'll be darned if her book was not the finalist for the International Thriller Writer's Best First Novel.
Wow.
And I said, man, that exonerates us.
Yes.
You know, now nobody can say you self-published. I published an award-winning book from one of the biggest worldwide organizations going. I was proud of her, I was proud of the book, and I was certainly thrilled that, you know, it didn't appear any longer to be a self-published thing. So that was 2006. We put out five books. Excuse me, 2007-6, 2008-7. This year, 2009, we put out 12 hardcover, one a month, and we've converted four of our books to paperback. And we already have some books in paper. Now, in those first 4 years now, we have licensed, one book became a Doubleday Mystery Book Club Book of the Month. Two books have been published by Thorndike Large Print. Two books by Brilliance, by Blackstone Audio. And we have one book now being translated into Korean. So we've done fairly well in a short time. We've gotten a lot of prizes. And our mission and our statement in our website says we will accept agented or unagented authors. So we're helping several new authors, and that makes us feel good. And we're doing very well for the authors we have. I mean, many of them are getting prizes. We have a pretty complete traditional type publishing company. We pay in advance and a royalty. We have a publicist. We have distribution all over the United States and in England and the English-speaking European countries.
You're serious.
We're serious.
Yeah.
We're serious. So, and we're having a lot of fun with it. And, you know, yesterday at this meeting, I gave an hour's talk on publishing, which is amazing since 4 years ago I could hardly spell publishing. But, so, you know, it's nice. And we are passionate about it, and we're excited about it. And everything we're doing, I mean, it's, our friends think we're crazy. I mean, our getting out of work, our retirement lasted about a year maybe, and even at that we were consulting back in writing. It's disappeared. I mean, the publishing business is a 7 day a week.
Yes, yeah, it's a full-time.
It's a full-time. The wine stuff doesn't take a lot of time, but you know, we do go there. We spend about a month and a half a year in New Zealand. And then trying to write. So we are, and then we volunteer at a low-income senior citizen clinic here in Sarasota, the Senior Friendship Center, and we volunteer in a hospice in New York. And I'm on one university board, one company board, and a huge hospital group board. It's 55 hospitals, Christus Health. And I chair their quality improvement committee, and I'm on about five other committees. So I'm in Dallas about 2 days a month.
Oh, my goodness.
And my wife is on the board of the Sarnoff Corporation, which is a high-tech thing. So she's up in New Jersey every couple months. And she's very busy at the Senior Friendship Center because she's one of the few primary care physicians. We're all volunteers and retirees. But she gets, because everybody else are specialists, they don't know what to do. So she, because we're not doing surgery or anything like that. So she gets all these new patients because she does the physicals and she's primary care.
She does the intake.
She does all the intake. So she's very busy over there. So it's an incredible life. Our kids don't know what we're doing. They can't figure out why we're doing all this or what we're going to do next. And
this is truly an artistic life.
It is. And it's
a
wonderful life.
It's truly an artistic life. And I'm really, it's lovely to hear this. It's lovely to hear this.
You
hear so many people doing what they want to do but not quite being able to make it happen or enjoy it, you know. It's really lovely to hear a story.
Thank you. Well, we had an interesting thing happen. Our condo association where we live here in Longboat Key invited us. They said they have a bring-your-own-bottle dinner once a month, and they said, would you come and speak? Because they have speakers generally from within the condos, because there are 172 condos. It's a very big place. And they said, no, we never see you guys because you're always working and everybody's wondering. They know what you're doing, sort of, but they wonder how you did that or how you got there, you know. And so they'd like to hear you guys talk.
Your story.
So,
mm-hmm.
So we went and we gave a talk. There were about 80 people there, and there all kind of questions, and we spoke for almost an hour. And afterwards, a guy by the name of Phil Kotler, who's a marketing professor at Northwestern who lives here part-time, and a guru in marketing. He consults all over the world. He's written many, many textbooks on marketing. Came running over. He goes, Bob, he said, how would you like another career? I said, Phil, I already have probably two more careers than I need. I said, but...
What do you got in mind?
What are you talking about? He said, you got to go on the road. He said, that was one of the most inspirational talks
right.
I've ever heard. He said, you've got to tell your story.
Right.
He said, for anybody who's retired or approaching retirement, it's greater for anybody. He said, it's just a very inspirational story. I said, Phil, I don't think Pat, when Pat was standing there, I said, I don't think we want to go on a road as inspirational speakers. I mean, you know, we don't mind talking, but I don't feel like I'm an inspirational speaker. I'm not out there beating a drum.
When did this happen?
This happened about 8 months ago. So he said, well, think about it. So we went home, and a couple nights later, I was lying in bed, and I'm thinking, I don't want to do this. So that morning, I woke Pat up. I said, Pat, I got an idea. I said, what? I said, let's write a book.
I was going to say, that is the way to do it.
So we wrote a book, which we've just completed yesterday, final, completed yesterday, which will come out in January, called What's Next for You?
You will go on the road now.
And I will go on the road. if it takes off at all, we'll go on the road.
Absolutely.
And it tells the story that I just told you. And it's written in a witty way. It doesn't, it's not the typical inspirational or guide, you know, that you make
these
a list of your dreams
to,
and
right,
you know,
right.
narrow it down to
right, right.
three and do this and do that. It tells our story, and it says one of the things, we did sort of coin a term. We call it thoughtful impulsiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of things we just did were sort of crazy. I mean, we decided on spur of the moment. And it's the same way we buy art or we buy books or we do buy clothes or we do anything.
It's the way you
it's
live.
It's sort of quick.
You know? It's the way you live.
It's
you
the
live
way
from
live.
Your heart. You live from intuition.
I guess that's what it is.
Yeah. And
but
that is, it seems to me, forgive me, but I mean, it's counterculture. You know, it's the opposite of the conventional wisdom, which is that, you know, you think this through, you make, you know, you write the pros and the cons, and then you take the first step or whatever it
right.
is. That's the conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
And the result of that, I think, is a lot of unhappy people who don't do much of anything.
Well, that's what we said in the book. We said, in our opinion, thoughtful impulsiveness conquers paralysis by analysis all the time.
Yes.
So we don't analyze to the point where we get paralyzed.
No. And if you make a mistake, you make a mistake.
Yeah. And we point out in the book that, you know, there are all kinds of levels at which you can do this. Obviously, somebody's going to say, oh, you guys, sure, you could do all this. You have
the money. Right.
But that's not the only way to do it. And in the book, I tell the story of my Aunt Alice, who, she was 11 years old. My dad was 13 when they were orphaned in Russia. And they were spirited out of Russia. It was during the Bolshevik Revolution. Spirited out of Russia by friends and a few relatives. Got to England. We're going to be put on a boat. My Aunt Alice got measles. They were there 6 months because she got quarantined. Got to this country in Detroit. Were put in with some relatives. Their education ended. Never went back to school beyond that age. My dad left eventually. Went to New York. Had a few jobs. And ended up meeting my mother in Toledo and settling in Pittsburgh as a laborer. My Aunt Alice stayed there, and she got married to a barber when she was 20 years old. And she stayed at home. She never got a driver's license. She still had her Russian accent. She didn't go out that much. She had a garden. She had three kids. Real homebody. Took care of everything. When Max was 58, he had a stroke and died, so very suddenly. And she was widowed, and kids were grown, pretty grown up. And she decided she was going to do something now. So at 60 years old, she went out and got a driver's license. Took her three times because she didn't understand. Her English wasn't, comprehension wasn't that good. So for the questions, but she passed. She went to a vocational center, 60 years old, and said, I want to get a job or be trained. They got her a job in a nursing home. She worked there. She was 65. They asked her if she's going to retire. She said, I don't want to retire. I like taking care of the old people. At 70, the union forced her to retire. She went back to the vocational center.
She said, I need another job.
I want
job.
To be trained. She said, I want another job, 70 years old. They said, well, you know, we don't know. But they put her in a jewelry store. She was sort of like the gal Friday. She cleaned the shelves. She made the coffee. She did everything. They loved her there. She worked there from the time she was 70 until she was 80. They were so worried about her driving around Detroit in winter, 5 days a week she comes to work, that they kept saying, maybe you ought to retire, Alice. So at 80 years old, they gave her a trip to Las Vegas with $1,000 to gamble for her retirement. She came back from Vegas, goes back to the vocational center, 8 years old. She says, I want to be retrained for a job. They said,
"What? Are you?
We don't think you should do that. Why don't you take a course? We have some wonderful drawing and painting courses. Why don't you try that? Said, okay, I'll try that. She, turns out she was very talented. She did, I'll say she did at least 100 paintings. Over the next 10 years, between 80 and 89 actually. She died at 89. But she, her paintings were incredible. She painted, she liked to paint clowns and animals, and what she would do is ask children to bring her pictures of their pets or some of their favorite cartoon character, tear it out of the paper, and then she would draw it and paint it and frame it and give it back to the kid. Plus, she learned to make afghans. She made afghans for everybody. My wife has an afghan. Every relative I have has an afghan. She did all this. She drove her neighbors to the doctors, everywhere. You know, from the time, from 60 to 89, she changed her life totally. And she went out and did things she never dreamed she would be able to do. And she never stopped. I mean, until the day she died, she was painting and doing all this stuff. And she had no money. I mean, she had very little money. And yet, here was a woman who
did... with a very, very passionate life.
Very much what we did, at a different level, at a different scale, different things, but had a very passionate life. So, tell people in a book, you don't need... Everybody can do it at their level. Some people have more financial capability, can do different things. With less, you do other things. But you better do something that keeps you happy and keeps you active, and you'll be a lot happier. And Pat did a chapter in the book about the word retirement, which she hates. So when we were getting ready to retire, I said, we're talking to somebody. I said, what are you going to do? I'm going to retire. So I get home that night, Pat says, don't say we're going to retire. I go, okay, Pat, what do you want me to say? She goes, graduate. We're going to graduate. Okay. Hey, folks, we're going to graduate from Johnson & Johnson. I just want you to know that. She goes, well, you know, it sounds silly, but I don't like the word retire. So she goes to the dictionary of synonyms. She spells out retire, put on a shelf, all these bad things.
Right.
And then she talks about graduation and better terms, and she realized their problem. And then she ends up saying, you know, that the geniuses who make out the forms that have pensioners sign, you know, retired,
right,
should come up with a better word. That's what they should do. She said, because we don't want to be put on the shelf. We want to do other things. And, you know, and I do a little bit in the book about, actually, the nutrition and health has changed so much. I mean, to me, the 60-year-old of today is the 40-year-old of 25 years ago from
That's
a health
right.
standpoint. So why stop when you're 62 or 65 and do nothing? You can do a lot, and you can do a lot way beyond that age. And, you know, I say there are people love to play golf and they want to play golf every day. That's fine. If they're happy and they're passionate about that, that's great. If you want to travel all the time, we travel a lot, partly on business, partly on pleasure. We squeeze it in. But there are people who just want to travel all the time, and they're retired, and they have the funds to do that. That's wonderful. But, you know, think about what... Do you have any dreams? Do you have any dreams about what you really would like to do?
Of course, that's the point, isn't it? That if you have a passion for something, you can find a way to do it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Pat and I have both been very fortunate in our life in that while we've done things all of our life, really, that we've been passionate about, the medical stuff, the research, I loved it. I told people all through my career, I'm being paid for my hobby. And I say in a book, and I've said it to people before, if I can't stand to have somebody tell me, I wake up in the morning and I dread going to work. Why do it then? Why do you do that? You're doing it for your whole life. Do something you love. I mean, I couldn't wait to get there. It's because there were things I wanted to pursue. I wanted to figure out. And we're doing the same thing now. I mean, I love it. And the good fortune is we're doing good while we're doing
well.
You know?
I know.
We're doing what we like to do. We're having a ball. Whether we, you know, it's not making much money, if any, but you know, we're doing okay. But at the same time, during our career in medicine, I think we help people with cures and diagnostics and things that we played a role in that help people all over the world. And I think we're helping people now with publishing, and hopefully they enjoy our books as well. So, and the wine business, I mean, who doesn't like good wine?
That's right.
So we're certainly helping
you're not
people
doing
there.
You're not harming anybody
not
anywhere.
Right. But and it's even good for your health.
It's really That's right. I do think that what is the most profound thing about what you're saying is the, I'm going to go back to that word passion, you know, that you, and probably it comes down to you through your Aunt Alice.
She was a great inspiration.
There's no question about it. And the belief that one can feel useful, do what one wants to do, pursue a passion, that belief. See, I think a lot of people don't have that. They don't know that that's possible for them. They think they have to do some... My ex-husband's father used to say, work, nobody likes it, everybody has to do it. And I think that's more the conventional wisdom.
I agree.
You know, and so for you to be saying this to my audience, which is internet, so it's all over the world, and for you to be writing it, and I'm quite sure you're going to be out on the road speaking about it, I think this is yet another permutation of how you're going to do good, which,
thank you.
God bless you.
I hope so. Thank you. And we're having a ball doing it.
Yes, and see, I think that's always the truth. Mm-hmm. I think that's always the truth, that if you do what you're doing, you do have fun doing it.
Right.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So, my God, thank you so much. This has been just wonderful.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
And is there anything else you'd like to say?
I think I've given you a pretty good idea of what we're doing, where we're going. I guess the only thing I'll tell you, one little story at the end here. We were sitting at dinner a few weeks ago, and I said to Pat, you know what, I think I'm going to give our golf clubs away. She goes, what?
You have no time
to
play.
We haven't played in like 4 years. I'll give them to one of our kids. She said, you can't do that. We're going to play. I said, when? It was a sunny night. She said, tomorrow. I said, are you serious? She said, yeah, we'll play tomorrow. So I went to bed. And I got up in the morning. What are we going to do? She goes, we're going to play golf. So we went out and we played 9 holes of golf, you know. So she said, you know, I don't mind once in a while we spend a few hours and play golf. And neither one of us are fanatics.
So obviously.
I won't throw the golf clubs out or give them away. I'll keep them, and we'll play every few months or so, you know. So she said, maybe in the next graduation, we'll play a lot more golf.
That's right. So hold on to those clubs because you never know.
Right, I'll wait.
That's a great story. Well, congratulations to you on all of your graduations and many more to come.
Thank you very much.
So that was Bob Gussin. And if you were paying attention and you heard that he retired in February of 2000 on his 62nd anniversary year of being with the company, then if you can do the math, you know that he's probably in his 71st year. And in this, his 71st year, he is beginning a new career, that of potentially, anyway, motivational speaker. This is, of course, an unusual thing. Although I think more and more the pressure is on us not to retire, that is, physically or emotionally, but to continue to grow. And in actual fact, this is not simply an issue for those of us who are in our 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. This is an issue for all of us. The can we be all that we can be, to quote that terrible saying, slogan, jingle from the Army. We do all want to be, deserve to be, not only all that we can be, but all that we are. As I say over and over again, this show and my soapbox is about the ability of all of us to be who we really are, not to settle for the who we thought we had to be, the who we pretended to be in order to make our family comfortable, in order to maintain the family balance. So when you listen to someone like Bob Gussin and you imagine the kind of woman he must be married to, because she too just keeps emerging into new aspects of herself. These people look out into the world and they look into themselves and they say, ooh, what's in there? Let's look closer at that. Yes, I didn't look at that before, but that's very interesting. Let me take that out and play with it. These people are people who have extraordinary permission to explore the territory of themselves. Most of us don't. And the premise of this show, the point of this show, the intention of this show is to keep making the point that most of us are keeping many and often significant aspects of ourselves from ourselves, not only from the world, not only hiding our light under a bushel, we don't even know what the light is. And so this show attempts to, at the beginning of every show, as much as I can, to talk about the things that stop us from discovering who we are and having discovered it, having the ability to demonstrate who we are, but also to interview people who in some aspect of their lives, and it seems to me that the Gussins probably in most areas of their life, are actually who they really are. Deeply connected to their own source, deeply attached to the being who they are, and you can hear the joy and the delight and the pleasure in this man's voice. So, if you tune in next week, then I will be talking about cover story. That is what we have been demonstrating, right? Now, again, this is not untrue of us. It's true of us. It's just not all that we are. So I'll be talking about how you created a cover story, how you can tell if it's a cover story, how you can begin to discover your undercover. Not all next week, but over the next weeks. So, as always, I hope that this show brought you something that maybe you didn't know before, or something you'd forgotten, something that interested you, got your curiosity up, stimulated or motivated you. Well, something that makes you want to come back next week. Because, as always, I will be here next week. Oh, gosh. And before I say the last line of this show, I need not to forget to thank, as I always do, Josh Hackney, without whom this show truly could not occur. Because there are a number of things about putting together this show that I don't know how to do. And all of those things Josh does know how to do and does them for me. And we'll do them for you. So even if you don't have a radio show, if you need to learn to work on your computer, or you have electronic questions or computing questions or recording questions, Josh Hackney is the man. And you can get to him as you can get to me by going up on my website, thelynnshow.com. Don't forget to put the E after Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E. And so now I'm just going to say what I always say, which is, I hope you'll be back too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retired. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime.